Was I? The thought of bravery had never crossed his mind, only his fear. The fear had been too big to see anything else, if anything else had indeed been there. Come on, Pete. What are we going to tell Mom? Hal smiled. I don't know, big guy. We'll think of something. He paused a moment longer, looking at the boards floating on the water. The lake was calm again, sparkling with small wavelets. Suddenly Hal thought of summer people he didn't even know. A man and his son, perhaps, fishing for the big one. I got something, Dad, the boy screams. Well, reel it up and let's see, the father says. And coming up from the depths, weeds dragging from its symbols, grinning its terrible, welcoming grin, the monkey. He shuddered, but those were only things that might be. Come on, he said to Petey again, and they walked up the path through the flaming October woods towards the home place. From the Bridgeton News, October 24th, 1980. Mystery of the Dead Fish by Betsy Moriarty. Hundreds of dead fish were found floating belly up on Crystal Lake in the neighboring township of Casco late last week. The largest numbers appear to have died in the vicinity of Hunter's Point, although the lake's currents make this a bit difficult to determine. The dead fish included all types commonly found in these waters: bluegills, pickerel, sunnies, carp, hornpout, brown and rainbow trout, even one landlocked salmon. Fish and game authorities say they are mystified.
Cain Rose Up. Read by Kyle Beltran.
Garish walked out of the bright May sunshine and into the coolness of the dorm. It took his eyes a moment to adjust, and at first, Harry the Beaver was just a bodiless voice from the shadows. "It was a bitch, wasn't it?" the Beaver asked. "Wasn't that one a really, truly bitch?" "Yes," Garish said. "It was tough." Now his eyes pulled in the Beaver. He was rubbing a hand across the pimples on his forehead and sweating under his eyes. He was wearing sandals and a 69 t-shirt with a button on the front that said, "Howdy Doody was a pervert." The Beaver's huge buck teeth loomed in the gloom. "I was gonna drop it in January," the Beaver said. "I kept telling myself to do it while there was still time. And then ad drop was over, and it was either go for it or pick up an incomplete. I think I flunked it, Kurt. Honest to God." The house mother stood in the corner by the mailboxes. She was an extremely tall woman who looked vaguely like Rudolph Valentino. She was trying to push a slip strap back under the sweaty armhole of her dress with one hand, while she tacked up a dorm sign-out sheet with the other. "Tough," Garish repeated. "I wanted to bag a few off you, but I didn't dare, honest to God. That guy's got eyes like an eagle. You think you got your A all right?" "I guess maybe I flunked," Garish said. The Beaver gaped. "You think you flunked? You think you..." "I'm going to take a shower, okay?" "Yeah, sure, Kurt, sure. Was that your last test?" "Yes," Garish said. "That was my last test." Garish crossed the lobby and pushed through the doors and began to climb. The stairwell smelled like an athletic supporter. Same old stairs. His room was on the fifth floor. Quinn and that other idiot from three, the one with the hairy legs, piled by him, tossing a softball back and forth. A little fellow wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a valiantly struggling goatee passed him between four and five, holding a calculus book to his chest like a Bible, his lips moving in a rosary of logarithms. His eyes were blank as blackboards. Garish paused and looked after him, wondering if he wouldn't be better off dead. But the little fellow was now only a bobbing, disappearing shadow on the wall. It bobbed once more and was gone. Garish climbed to five and walked down the hall to his room. Pigpen had left 2 days ago. Four finals in 3 days, wham bam and thank you ma'am. Pigpen knew how to arrange things. He had left only his pinups, two dirty mismatched sweat socks, and a ceramic parody of Rodin's Thinker perched on a toilet seat. Garish put his key in the lock and turned it.
Kurt! Hey, Kurt!
Rollins, the asinine floor counselor who had sent Jimmy Brody up to visit the Dean of Men for a drinking offense, was coming down the hall and waving at him. He was tall, well-built, crew-cut, symmetrical. He looked varnished.
You all done? Rollins asked.
Yeah.
Don't forget to sweep the floor of the room and fill out the damage report, okay?
Yeah.
I slid a damage report under your door last Thursday, didn't I?
Yeah.
If I'm not in my room, just slide the damage report and the key under the door.
Okay. Rollins seized his hand and shook it twice, fast, pump pump. Rollins's palm was dry, the skin grainy. Shaking hands with Rollins was like shaking hands with a fistful of salt.
Have yourself a good summer, my man.
Right.
Don't work too hard.
No.
Use it, but don't abuse it.
I will and I won't. Rollins looked momentarily puzzled, and then he laughed.
Take care now.
He slapped Garish's shoulder, and then walked back down the hall, pausing once to tell Ron Frayne to turn down his stereo. Garish could see Rollins lying dead in a ditch, with maggots in his eyes. Rollins wouldn't care. Neither would the maggots. You either ate the world, or the world ate you, and it was okay either way. Garish stood thoughtfully, watching till Rollins was out of sight, and then he let himself into his room. With Pigpen's cyclonic clutter gone, it looked barren and sterile. The swirled, heaped, drifted pile that had been Pigpen's bed was stripped down to the bare, if slightly cum-stained, mattress pad. Two Playboy gatefolds looked down at him with frozen two-dimensional come-ons. Not much change in Garish's half of the room, which had always been barracks neat. You could drop a quarter on the top blanket of Garish's bed and it would bounce. All that neat had gotten on Piggy's nerves. He was an English major with a fine turn of phrase. He called Garish a pigeonholer. The only thing on the wall above Garish's bed was a huge blow-up of Humphrey Bogart that he had gotten in the college bookstore. Bogey had an automatic pistol in each hand, and he was wearing suspenders. Pigpen said pistols and braces were impotency symbols. Garish doubted if Bogey had been impotent, although he had never read anything about him. He went to the closet door, unlocked it, and brought out the big walnut stock .352 Magnum that his father, a Methodist minister, had bought him for Christmas. He had bought the telescopic sight himself last March. You weren't supposed to have guns in your room, not even hunting rifles, but it hadn't been hard. He had signed it out of the university gun storage room the day before with a forged withdrawal slip. He put it in its waterproof leather scabbard and left it in the woods behind the football field. Then, this morning, around 3 a.m., he just went out and got it, and brought it upstairs through the sleeping corridors. He sat down on the bed with the gun across his knees and wept a little bit. The thinker on the toilet seat was looking at him. Garish put the gun on his bed, crossed the room, and slapped it off Piggy's table and onto the floor, where it shattered. There was a knock at the door. Garish put the rifle under his bed.
Come in.
It was Bailey, standing there in his skivvies. There was a puff of lint in his belly button. There was no future for Bailey. Bailey would marry a stupid girl, and they would have stupid kids. Later on, he would die of cancer, or maybe renal failure.
How was the chem final, Kurt?
All right.
I just wanted to see if I could borrow your notes. I've got it tomorrow.
I burned them with my trash this morning.
Oh, hey, Jesus. Did Piggy go and do that?
He pointed at the remains of the thinker.
I guess so. Why did he want to go and do that? I like that thing. I was going to buy it off him.
Bailey had sharp, ratty little features. His skivvies were thready and saggy-seated. Garish could see exactly how he would look, dying of emphysema or something, in an oxygen tent. How he would look yellow.
I could help you, Garish thought. You think he'd mind if I scoffed up those pin-ups?
I guess not.
Okay.
Bailey crossed the room, stepping his bare feet gingerly over the pottery shards, and untacked the playmates.
That picture of Bogart is really sharp, too. No tits, but hey, you know?
Bailey peered at Garish to see if Garish would smile. When Garish did not, he said,
I don't suppose you plan on throwing it away or anything.
No, I was just getting ready to take a shower.
Okay, have a good summer if I don't see you again, Kurt.
Thanks. Bailey went back to the door, the seat of his skivvies flapping. He paused at the door.
Another 4 point this semester, Kurt?
At least.
Good deal. See you next year.
He went out and closed the door. Garrish sat on the bed for a little while, then took the gun out, stripped it, and cleaned it. He put the muzzle up to his eye and looked at the tiny circle of light at the far end. The barrel was clean. He reintegrated the gun. In the third drawer of his bureau were 3 heavy boxes of Winchester ammunition. He laid these on the windowsill. He locked the room's door and went back to the window. He pulled the blinds up. The mall was bright and green, peppered with strolling students. Quinn and his idiot friend had gotten up a raggle-taggle softball game. They scurried back and forth like crippled ants escaping a broken burrow.
"Let me tell you something," Garrish told Bogey. God got mad at Cain because Cain had an idea that God was a vegetarian. His brother knew better. God made the world in his image, and if you don't eat the world eats you. So Cain says to his brother, "Why didn't you tell me?" And his brother says, "Why didn't you listen?" And Cain says, "Okay, I'm listening now." So he waxes his brother and says, "Hey God, you want meat? Here it is. You want roast, or ribs, or Abel burgers, or what?" And God told him to put on his boogie shoes. So, what do you think?
No reply from Bogey.
Garrish put the window up and rested his elbows on the ledge, not letting the barrel of the .352 project out into the sunlight. He looked into the sight. He was centered on Carlton Memorial Women's Dormitory across the mall. Carlton was more popularly known as the Dog Kennels. He put the crosshairs on a big Ford wagon. A blonde coed in jeans and a blue shell top was talking to her mother, while her father, red-faced and balding, loaded suitcases into the back. Someone knocked on the door. Garrish waited. The knock came again.
"Kurt? I'll give you half a rock for the Bogart poster."
"Bailey." Garrish said nothing. The girl and her mother were laughing at something, not knowing there were microbes in their intestines, feeding, dividing, multiplying. The girl's father joined them, and they stood in the sunlight together, a family portrait in the crosshairs.
"Damn it all," Bailey said.
His feet padded down the hall. Garrish squeezed the trigger. The gun kicked hard against his shoulder, the good, padded kick you get when you have seated the gun in exactly the right place. The smiling girl's blonde head sheared itself away. Her mother went on smiling for a moment, and then her hand went to her mouth. She screamed through her hand. Garrish shot through it. Hand and head disappeared in a red spray. The man who had been loading the suitcases broke into a lumbering run. Garrish tracked him and shot him in the back. He raised his head, looking out of the sight for a moment. Quinn was holding the softball and looking at the blonde girl's brains, which were splattered on the no parking sign behind her prone body. Quinn didn't move. All across the mall, people stood frozen, like children engaged in a game of statues. Somebody pounded on the door, then rattled the handle. Bailey again.
"Kurt? You all right, Kurt? I think somebody's..."
"Good drink, good meat, good God, let's eat," Garrish exclaimed, and shot at Quinn. He pulled instead of squeezing, and the shot went wide. Quinn was running. No problem. The second shot took Quinn in the neck, and he flew maybe 20 feet.
"Kurt, Garrish is killing himself," Bailey was screaming. "Rollins! Rollins, come quick!"
His footsteps faded down the hall. Now they were starting to run. Garrish could hear them screaming. Garrish could hear the faint smack-smack sound of their shoes on the walks. He looked up at Bogey. Bogey held his 2 guns and looked beyond him. He looked at the shattered remnants of Piggy's thinker and wondered what Piggy was doing today, if he was sleeping or watching TV or eating some great big wonderful meal. "Eat the world, Piggy," Garrish thought. "You gulp that sucker right down."
"Garrish!"
It was Rollins now, pounding on the door.
Open up, Garish!
It's locked, Bailey panted.
He looked lousy. He killed himself, I know it.
Garish pushed the muzzle out of the window again. A boy in a Madger's shirt was crouched down behind a bush, scanning the dormitory windows with desperate intensity. He wanted to run for it, Garish saw, but his legs were frozen. Good God, let's eat, Garish murmured, and began to pull the trigger again.
Mrs. Todd's Shortcut. Read by Dana Ivey.
There goes the Todd woman, I said. Homer Buckland watched the little jaguar go by and nodded. The woman raised her hand to Homer. Homer nodded his big, shaggy head to her, but didn't raise his own hand in return. The Todd family had a big summer home on Castle Lake, and Homer had been their caretaker since time out of mind. I had an idea that he disliked Worth Todd's second wife, every bit as much as he liked Felia Todd, the first one. This was just about 2 years ago, and we were sitting on a bench in front of Bell's Market, me with an orange soda pop, Homer with a glass of mineral water. It was October, which is a peaceful time in Castle Rock. Lots of the lake places still get used on the weekends, but the aggressive, boozy summer socializing is over by then, and the hunters with their big guns and their expensive non-resident permits pinned to their orange caps haven't started to come into town yet. Crops have been mostly laid by. Nights are cool, good for sleeping, and old joints like mine haven't yet started to complain. In October, the sky over the lake is passing fair, with those big white clouds that move so slow. I like how they seem so flat on the bottoms, and how they are a little gray there, like with a shadow of sundown foretold, and I can watch the sun sparkle on the water and not be bored for some space of minutes. It's in October, sitting on the bench in front of Bell's and watching the lake from afar off, that I still wish I was a smoking man.
She don't drive as fast as Felia, Homer said. I swan, I used to think what an old-fashioned name she had for a woman that could put a car through its paces like she could.
Summer people like the Todds are nowhere near as interesting to the year-round residents of small Maine towns as they themselves believe. Year-round folk prefer their own love stories and hate stories and scandals and rumors of scandal. When that textile fellow from Amesbury shot himself, Estonia Corbridge found that, after a week or so, she couldn't even get invited to lunch on her story of how she found him with the pistol still in one stiffening hand. The folks are still not done talking about Joe Camber, who got killed by his own dog. Well, it don't matter. It's just that they are different race courses we run on. Some are people are trotters, us others that don't put on ties to do our week's work are just pacers. Even so, there was quite a lot of local interest when Ophelia Todd disappeared back in 1973. Ophelia was a genuinely nice woman, and she had done a lot of things in town. She worked to raise money for the Sloan Library, helped to refurbish the war memorial and that sort of thing. But all the summer people like the idea of raising money. You mention raising money and their eyes light up and commence to gleam. You mention raising money and they can get a committee together and appoint a secretary and keep an agenda. They like that. But you mention time. Beyond, that is, one big long walloper of a combined cocktail party and committee meeting, and you're out of luck. Time seems to be what summer people mostly set a store by. They lay it by, and if they could put it up in ball jars like preserves, why they would. But Felia Todd seemed willing to spend time, to do desk duty in the library as well as to raise money for it. When it got down to using scouring pads and elbow grease on the war memorial, Felia was right out there with town women who had lost sons in 3 different wars, wearing an overall with her hair done up in a kerchief. And when kids needed ferrying to a summer swim program, you'd be as apt to see her as anyone, headed down Landing Road with the back of Worth Todd's big shiny pickup full of kids. A good woman. Not a town woman, but a good woman. And when she disappeared, there was concern. Not grieving, exactly, because a disappearance is not exactly like a death. It's not like chopping something off with a cleaver. More like something running down the sink, so slow you don't know it's all gone until long after it is.
'Twas a Mercedes she drove, Homer said, answering the question I hadn't asked. 2-seater Sportster. Todd got it for her in 64 or 65, I guess. You remember her taking the kids to the lake all those years they had frogs and tadpoles?
Yeah.
She'd drive 'em no more than 40. Mindful they was in the back. But it chafed her. That woman had lead in her foot, and a ball bearing summers in the back of her ankle.
It used to be that Homer never talked about his summer people. But then his wife died. 5 years ago it was. She was plowing a grade, and the tractor tipped over on her, and Homer was taken bad off about it. He grieved for 2 years or so, and then seemed to feel better. But he was not the same. He seemed waiting for something to happen. Waiting for the next thing. He'd pass his neat little house sometimes at dusk, and he would be on the porch, smoking a pipe with a glass of mineral water on the porch rail, and the sunset would be in his eyes and pipe smoke around his head, and you'd think, I did anyway, Homer is waiting for the next thing. This bothered me over a wider range of my mind than I like to admit, and at last I decided it was because if it had been me, I wouldn't have been waiting for the next thing. Like a groom who has put on his morning coat and finally has his tie right and is only sitting there on a bed in the upstairs of his house and looking first at himself in the mirror and then at the clock on the mantel and waiting for it to be 11 o'clock so he can get married. If it had been me, I would not have been waiting for the next thing. I would have been waiting for the last thing. But in that waiting period, which ended when Homer went to Vermont a year later, he sometimes talked about these people, to me, to a few others.
She never even drove fast with a husband, as far as I know. But when I drove with her, she made that Mercedes strut.
A fellow pulled in at the pumps and began to fill up his car. The car had a Massachusetts plate.
It wasn't one of these new sports cars that run on unleaded gasoline and hitch every time you step on it. It was one of the old ones, and the speedometer was calibrated all the way up to 160. It was a funny color of brown, and I asked her one time what you call that color, and she said it was champagne. "Ain't that good," I says, and she laughs fit to split. I like a woman who will laugh when you don't have to point her right at the joke, you know.
The man at the pumps had finished getting his gas. "Afternoon, gentlemen," he says as he comes up the steps. "A good day to you," I says, and he went inside.
"Felia was always looking for a shortcut," Homer went on as if we had never been interrupted. "That woman was mad for a shortcut. I never saw the beat of it. She said if you can save enough distance,
You'll save time as well. She said her father swore by that scripture. He was a salesman, always on the road, and she went with him when she could. And he was always looking for the shortest way, so she got in the habit. I asked her one time if it wasn't kind of funny. Here she was on the one hand, spending her time rubbing up that old statue in the square, and taking the little ones to their swimming lessons instead of playing tennis and swimming and getting boozed up like normal summer people. And on the other hand, being so damn set on saving 15 minutes between here and Freiburg, that thinking about it probably kept her up nights. Just seemed to me the two things went against each other's grain, if you see what I mean. She just looks at me and says, "I like being helpful, Homer. I like driving, too, at least sometimes when it's a challenge. But I don't like the time it takes. It's like mending clothes. Sometimes you take tucks and sometimes you let things out. Do you see what I mean?" "I guess so, missus," I says, kind of dubious. If sitting behind the wheel of a car was my idea of a really good time all the time, I would look for long cuts, she says. And that tickled me so much I had to laugh. The Massachusetts fella came out of the store with a six-pack in one hand and some lottery tickets in the other. "You enjoy your weekend," Homer says. "I always do," the Massachusetts fellow says. "I only wish I could afford to live here all year round." "Well, we'll keep it all in good order for you when you can come," Homer says. And the fellow laughs. We watched him drive off toward some place, that Massachusetts plate showing. It was a green one. My Marcy says those are the ones the Massachusetts Motor Registry gives to drivers who ain't had an accident in that strange, angry, fuming state for 2 years. "If you have," she says, "you got to have a red one, so people know to watch out for you when they see you on the roll." "They was in-state people, you know, the both of them," Homer said, as if the Massachusetts fellow had reminded him of the fact. "I guess I did know that," I said. "The Todds are just about the only birds we got that fly north in the winter. The new one, I don't think she likes flying north too much." He sipped his mineral water and fell silent a moment, thinking. "She didn't mind it, though," Homer said. "At least, I judge she didn't, although she used to complain about it something fierce. The complaining was just a way to explain why she was always looking for a shortcut." "And you mean her husband didn't mind her traipsing down every wood road in Tarnation between here and Bangor just so she could see if it was 9/10 of a mile shorter?" "He didn't care piss all," Homer said shortly, and got up and went in the store. "There now, Owens," I told myself. "You know it ain't safe to ask Tim questions when he's yarning, and you went right ahead and asked one, and you have buggered a story that was starting to shape up promising." I sat there and turned my face up into the sun, and after about 10 minutes he came out with a boiled egg and sat down. He ate her, and I took care not to say nothing. And the water on Castle Lake sparkled as blue as something as might be told of in a story about treasure. When Homer had finished his egg and had a sip of mineral water, he went on. I was surprised, but still said nothing. It wouldn't have been wise. "They had 2 or 3 different chunks of rolling iron," he said. "There was the Cadillac, and his truck, and her little Mercedes Go-Devil. A couple of winters, he left the truck, case they wanted to come down and do some skiing. Mostly when the summer was over, he'd drive the caddy back up, and she'd take her Go-Devil." I nodded, but didn't speak. In truth, I was afraid to risk another comment. Later I thought it would have taken a lot of comments to shut Homer Buckland up that day. He had been wanting to tell the story of Mrs. Todd's shortcut for a long time. "Her little Go-Devil had a special odometer in it that told you how many miles was in a trip. And every time she set off from Castle Lake to Bangor, she'd set it to 000.0 and let her clock up to whatever. She'd made a game of it, and she used to chafe me with it." He paused, thinking that back over. "No, that ain't right." He paused more, and faint lines showed up on his forehead, like steps on a library ladder. "She made like she made a game of it. But it was a serious business to her. Serious as anything else, anyway. He flapped a hand, and I think he meant the husband. The glove box of the little go-devil was filled with maps, and there was a few more in the back, where there would be a seat in a regular car. Some was gas station maps, and some was pages that had been pulled from the Rand McNally Road Atlas. She had some maps from Appalachian Trail guidebooks and a whole mess of topographical survey squares, too. It wasn't her having those maps that made me think it weren't a game. It was how she drawed lines on all of them, showing routes she'd taken or at least tried to take. She'd been stuck a few times, too, and had to get a pull from some farmer with a tractor and chain. I was there one day, laying tile in the bathroom, sitting there with grout squittering out of every damn crack you could see. I dreamed of nothing but squares and cracks that was bleeding grout that night, and she come stood in the doorway and talked to me about it for quite a while. I used to chaff her about it, but I was also sort of interested, and not just because my brother Franklin used to live down Bangor, and I'd traveled most of the roads she was telling me of. I was interested just because a man like me is always uncommon interested in knowing the shortest way, even if he don't always want to take it. You that way, too?
Aya, I said.
There's something powerful about knowing the shortest way, even if you take the longer way because you know your mother-in-law is sitting home. Getting there quick is often for the birds, although no one holding a Massachusetts driver's license seems to know it. But knowing how to get there quick, or even knowing how to get there a way that the person sitting beside you don't know, that has power.
"Well, she had them roads like a Boy Scout has his knots," Homer said, and smiled his large, sunny grin. "She says, 'Wait a minute, wait a minute,' like a little girl, and I hear her through the wall, rummaging through her desk, and then she comes back with a little notebook that looked like she'd had it a good long time. Cover was all rumpled, don't you know, and some of the pages had pulled loose from those little wire rings on one side.
The way Worth goes, the way most people go, is Route 97 to Mechanic Falls, then Route 11 to Lewiston, and then the interstate to Bangor, 156.4 miles.
I nodded.
If you want to skip the turnpike and save some distance, you go to Mechanic Falls, Route 11 to Lewiston, Route 202 to Augusta, then up Route 9 through China Lake and Unity and Haven to Bangor. That's 144.9 miles.
"You won't save no time that way, missus," I says. "Not going through Lewiston and Augusta. Although I will admit, that drive up the old Dairy Road to Bangor is real pretty."
"Save enough miles, and soon enough you'll save time," she says. "And I didn't say that's the way I'd go, although I have a good many times. I'm just running down the routes most people use. Do you want me to go on?"
"No," I says. "Just leave me in this cussed bathroom all by myself, staring at all these cussed cracks until I start to rave."
"There are four major routes in all," she says. "The one by Route 2 is 163.4 miles. I only tried it once. Too long."
"That's one-eyed hosey if my wife called and told me it was leftovers," I says, kind of low.
"What was that?" she says.
"Nothing," I says. "Talking to the grout."
"Oh. Well, the fourth, and there aren't too many who know about it, although they are all good roads, paved anyway, is across Speckled Bird Mountain on 219 to 202 beyond Lewiston. Then, if you take Route 19, you can get around Augusta. Then you take the old Dairy Road. That way is just 129.2.
I didn't say nothing for a little while, and perhaps she thought I was doubting her because she says a little pert, "I know it's hard to believe, but it's so." I said I guess that was about right, and I thought, looking back, it probably was, because that's the way I'd usually go when I went down to Bangor to see Franklin when he was still alive. I hadn't been that way in years, though. Do you think a man could just, well, forget a road, Dave?
I allowed it was. The turnpike is easy to think of. After a while, it almost fills a man's mind. And you think not how could I get from here to there, but how can I get from here to the turnpike ramp that's closest to there? And that made me think that maybe there are lots of roads all over that are just going begging, roads with rock walls beside them, Real roads with blackberry bushes growing alongside them, but nobody to eat the berries but the birds. And gravel pits with old rusted chains hanging down in low curves in front of their entryways. The pits themselves, as forgotten as a child's old toys, with scrumgrass growing up their deserted, unremembered sides. Roads that have just been forgot, except by the people who live on them, and think of the quickest way to get off them, and on to the turnpike, where you can pass on a hill and not fret over it. We like to joke in Maine that you can't get there from here, but maybe the joke is on us. The truth is, there's about a damn thousand ways to do it, and man doesn't bother. Homer continued. I grouted tile all afternoon in that hot little bathroom, and she stood there in the doorway all that time, one foot crossed behind the other, bare-legged, wearing loafers and a khaki-colored skirt and a sweater that was some darker. Hair was drawed back in a hustail. She must have been 34 or 35 then, but her face was lit up with what she was telling me, and I swan she looked like a sorority girl home from school on vacation. After a while, she must have got an idea of how long she'd been there, cutting the air around her mouth, because she says, I must be boring the hell out of you, Homer. Yes'm, I says, you are. I'd rather you went away and left me to talk to this damn grout. Don't be smart, Homer, she says. No, missus, you ain't boring me, I says. So she smiles and then goes back to it, paging through a little notebook, like a salesman checking his orders. She had those four main ways, well, really three, because she gave up on Route 2 right away. But she must have had 40 different other ways that were playoffs on those. Roads with state numbers, roads without, roads with names, roads without. My head fair spun with them, and finally she says to me, You ready for the blue ribbon winner, Homer? I guess so, I says. At least it's the blue ribbon winner so far, she says. Do you know, Homer, that a man wrote an article in Science Today in 1923 proving that no man could run a mile in under 4 minutes? He proved it with all sorts of calculations based on the maximum length of the male thigh muscles, maximum length of stride, maximum lung capacity, maximum heart rate, and a whole lot more. I was taken with that article. I was so taken that I gave it to Worth and asked him to give it to Professor Murray in the math department at the University of Maine. I wanted those figures checked because I was sure they must have been based on the wrong postulates or something. Worth probably thought I was being silly. Ophelia's got a bee in her bonnet, is what he says. But he took them. Well, Professor Murray checked through the man's figures quite carefully, and do you know what, Homer? No, missus. Those figures were right. The man's criteria were solid. He proved back in 1923 that a man couldn't run a mile in under 4 minutes. He proved that. But people do it all the time, and do you know what that means? No, missus, I said, although I had a glimmer. It means that no blue ribbon is forever, she says. Someday, if the world doesn't explode itself in the meantime, someone will run a 2-minute mile in the Olympics. It may take 100 years or 1,000, but it will happen because there is no ultimate blue ribbon. There is zero, and there is eternity, and there is mortality, but there is no ultimate. And there she stood. Her face clean and scrubbed and shining. That darkish hair of hers pulled back from her brow as if to say, Just you go ahead and disagree if you can. But I couldn't, because I believe something like that. It is much like what the minister means, I think, when he talks about grace.
You ready for the blue ribbon winner for now? She says.
Yeah, I says. And I even stopped grouting for the time being. I'd reached the tub anyway, and there wasn't nothing left but a lot of those frickin' squirrely little corners. She drawed a deep breath and then
spieled it out at me as fast as that auctioneer goes over in Gates Falls when he's been putting the whiskey to himself, and I can't remember it all, but it went something like this.
Homer Buckland shut his eyes for a moment, his big hands lying perfectly still on his long thighs, his face turned up toward the sun. Then he opened his eyes again, and for a moment I swan he looked like her. Yes, he did. A 70-year-old man looking like a woman of 34, who was at that moment in her time looking like a college girl of 20. And I can't remember exactly what he said, any more than he could remember exactly what she said, not just because it was complex, but because I was so fetched by how he looked saying it, but it went close enough like this. You set out Route 97, and then cut up Denton Street to the old townhouse road, and that way you get around Castle Rock downtown, but back to 97. 9 miles up, you can go an old Lockers Road a mile and a half to Town Road Number 6, which takes you to Big Anderson Road by Sight's Cider Mill. There's a cut road the old-timers call Bear Road, and that gets you to 219. Once you're on the far side of Speckleberg Mountain, you grab the Stanhouse Road, then turn left onto the Bull Pine Road. There's a swampy patch there, but you can spang right through it if you can get up enough speed on the gravel, and so you come out on Route 106. 106 cuts through Alton's Plantation to the Old Dairy Road, and there's two or three woods roads there that you follow, and so come out on Route 3 just beyond Dairy Hospital. From there, it's only 4 miles to Route 2 in Etna, and so into Bangor. She paused to get her breath back, then looked at me. "Do you know how long that is, all told?"
"No'm," I says, thinking it sounds like about 190 miles and 4 bust springs.
"It's 116.4 miles, she says. I laughed. The laugh was out of me before I thought I wasn't doing myself any favor if I wanted to hear this story to the end. But Homer grinned himself and nodded.
"I know, and you know I don't like to argue with anyone, Dave. But there's a difference between having your leg pulled and getting it shook like a damn apple tree."
"You don't believe me," she says.
"Well, it's hard to believe, missus," I said.
"Leave that grout to dry, and I'll show you," she says. "You can finish behind the tub tomorrow. Come on, Homer. I'll leave a note for Worth. He may not be back tonight anyway, and you can call your wife. We'll be sitting down to dinner in the Pilot's Grill in," she looks at her watch, 2 hours and 45 minutes from right now, and if it's a minute longer, I'll buy you a bottle of Irish Mist to take home with you. You see? My dad was right. Save enough miles, and you'll save time, even if you have to go through every damn bog and sump in Kennebec County to do it. Now, what do you say?"
She was looking at me with her brown eyes, just like lamps. There was a devilish look in them. It said, "Turn your cap around backwards, Homer, and climb aboard this hoss. I be first, and you be second, and let the devil take the hindmost." And there was a grin on her face that said the exact same thing. And I tell you, Dave, I wanted to go. I didn't even want to top that damn can of grout. But I certain sure didn't want to drive that go-devil of hers. I wanted just to sit in it on the shotgun side and watch her get in, see her skirt come up a little, see her pull it down over her knees a knot, watch her hair shine. He trailed off and suddenly let off a sarcastic, choked laugh. That laugh of his sounded like a shotgun loaded with rock salt. "Just call up Megan and say, 'You know, Felia Todd, that woman you're halfway to being so jealous of now you can't see straight and can't ever find a good word to say about her? Well, her and me is going to make this speed run down to Bangor in that little champagne-colored go-devil Mercedes of hers, so don't wait dinner. Just call her up and say that, 'Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.'"
And he laughed again with his hands lying there on his legs, just as natural as ever was. And I seen something in his face that was almost hateful. And after a minute he took his glass of mineral water from the railing there and got outside some of it.
"You didn't go," I said. "Not them," he laughed. And this laugh was gentler. "She must have seen something in my face, because it was like she found herself again. She stopped looking like a sorority girl and just looked like Felia Todd again.
She looked down at the notebook like she didn't know what it was she'd been holding and put it down by her side, almost behind her skirt. I says, "I'd like to do just that thing, Mrs., but I got to finish up here, and my wife has got a roast on for dinner." She says, "I understand, Homer. I just got a little carried away. I do that a lot, all the time," Worth says. Then she kind of straightened up and says, "But the offer holds, any time you want to go. You can even throw your shoulder to the back end if we get stuck somewhere. Might save me $5. And she laughed. "I'll take you up on it, Missus," I says. And she seen that I meant what I said and wasn't just being polite. "And before you just go believing that 116 miles to Bangor is out of the question, get out your own map and see how many miles it would be as the crow flies." I finished the tiles and went home and ate leftovers. There wasn't no roast. And I think Felia Todd knew it. And after Megan was in bed, I got out my yardstick and a pen and my mobile map of the state, and I did what she had told me. Because it had laid hold my mind a bit, you see. I drew a straight line and did out the calculations according to the scale of miles. I was some surprised, because if you went from Castle Rock up there to Bangor like one of those little Piper cubs could fly on a clear day, if you didn't have to mind lakes or stretches of lumber company woods that was chained off, or bogs, or crossing rivers where there weren't no bridges, why, it would be just 79 miles, give or take. I jumped a little. "Measure it yourself if you don't believe me," Homer said. "I never knew Maine was so small until I seen that." He had himself a drink and then looked around at me. "There come a time, the next spring, when Megan was away in New Hampshire, visiting with a brother. I had to go down to the Todd's house to take off the storm doors and put on the screens. And her little Mercedes Go Devil was there. She was down by herself. She come to the door and says, 'Homer, have you come to put on the screen doors?' And right off I says, 'No, missus, I come to see if you want to give me a ride down to Bangor the short way.' Well, she looked at me with no expression on her face at all. And I thought she had forgotten all about it. I felt my face getting red the way it will when you feel you just pulled one hell of a boner. Then just when I was getting ready to apologize, her face bursts into that grin again and she says, 'You just stand right there while I get my keys and don't change your mind, Homer.' She come back a minute later with them in her hand. 'If we get stuck, you'll see mosquitoes just about the size of dragonflies.' 'I've seen 'em as big as English sparrows up in Rangeley, missus,' I said, 'and I guess we're both a spot too heavy to be carried off.' She laughs. 'Well, I warned you anyway. Come on, Homer.' 'And if we ain't there in 2 hours and 45 minutes, I says, kinda sly, 'you was gonna buy me a bottle of Irish mist.' She looks at me kinda surprised. The driver's door of the Go Devil open and 1 foot inside. 'Hell, Homer,' she says, 'I told you that was the blue ribbon for then. I found a way up there that's shorter. We'll be there in 2.5 hours. Get in here, Homer. We're going to roll.' He paused again, hands lying calm on his thighs, his eyes dulling, perhaps seeing that champagne-colored two-seater heading up the Todd's steep driveway. She stood the car still at the end of it and says, 'You sure?' 'Let her rip,' I says. The ball bearing in her ankle rolled, and that heavy foot come down. I can't tell you nothing much about what all happened after that, except after a while I couldn't hardly take my eyes off her. There was something wild that crept into her face, Dave, something wild and something free, and it frightened my heart. She was beautiful. And I was took with love for her. Anyone would have been. Any man, anyway. And maybe any woman, too. But I was scared of her, too, because she looked like she could kill you if her eye left the road and fell on you and she decided to love you back. She was wearing blue jeans and an old white shirt with the sleeves rolled up, I had an idea she was maybe fixing to paint something on the back deck when I came by. But after we'd been going for a while, seemed like she was dressed in nothing but all this white, billowy stuff, like a picture in one of those old gods and goddesses books. He thought, looking out across the lake, his face very somber. Like the huntress that was supposed to drive the moon across the sky. Diana? Yeah. Moon was her go-devil. Felia looked like that to me. And I just tell you fair out that I was stricken in love for her and never would have made a move, even though I was some younger then than I am now. I would not have made a move even had I been 20. Although, I suppose I might have at 16 and been killed for it. Killed, if she looked at me, was the way it felt. She was like that woman driving the moon across the sky. Halfway up over the splashboard with her gossamer stoles all flying out behind her in silver cobwebs. And her hair streaming back to show the dark little hollows of her temples. Lashing those horses. Telling me to get along, faster, never mind how they blow, just faster, faster, faster. We went down a lot of woods roads, the first two or three I knew, and after that I didn't know none of them. We must have been a sight to those trees that had never seen nothing with a motor in it before but big old pulp trucks and snowmobiles. That little go-devil that would most likely have looked more at home on the Sunset Boulevard than shooting through those woods, spitting and bullin' its way up one hill and then slamming down the next through those dusty green bars of afternoon sunlight. She had the top down, and I could smell everything in those woods. And you know what an old fine smell that is, like something which has been mostly left alone and is not much troubled. We went on across corduroy, which had been laid over some of the boggiest parts. Black mud squelched up between some of those cut logs, and she laughed like a kid. Some of the logs was old and rotted because there hadn't been nobody down a couple of those roads, except for her, that is, and I'm going to say 5 or 10 years. We was alone, except for the birds and whatever animals seen us. The sound of that go-devil's engine, first buzzing along and then winding up high and fierce when she punched into clutch and shifted down. That was the only motor sound I could hear. And although I knew we had to be close to someplace all the time, I mean, these days you always are, I started to feel like we had gone back in time, that there wasn't nothing. That if we stopped and I climbed a high tree, I wouldn't see nothing in any direction but woods and woods, and more woods. And all the time, she's just hammering that thing along, her hair all out behind her, smiling her eyes, flashing. So we come out on the Speckled Bird Mountain Road, and for a while I known where we were again, and then she turned off, and for just a little bit I thought I knew. And then I didn't even bother to kid myself no more. We went cut-slam down another woods road, and then we come out, I swear it, on a nice paved road with a sign that said Motorway B. You ever heard of a road in the state of Maine that was called Motorway B? No, I says. Sounds English. Yeah. Looked English. These trees, like willows, overhung the road. Now watch out here, Homer, she says. One of those nearly grabbed me a month ago and gave me an Indian burn. I didn't know what she was talking about and started to say so, and then I seen that even though there was no wind, the branches of those trees was dipping down. They was wavering down. They looked black and wet inside the fuzz of green on them. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Then one of them snatched off my cap, and I knew I wasn't asleep. "Hi!" I shouts. "Give that back!" "Too late now, Homer," she says and laughs. "There's daylight just up ahead. We're okay."
Then another one of them comes down, on her side this time, and snatches at her. I swear I did. She ducked, and it caught in her hair, and pulled a lock of it out. Ouch! Damn it, that hurts! She yells. But she was laughing, too. The car swerved a little when she ducked, and I got a look into the woods, and holy God, Dave, everything in there was moving. There was grasses waving and plants. It was all knotted together, so it seemed like they made faces. And I seen something sitting in a squat on top of a stump, and it looked like a tree toad. Only it was as big as a full-grown cat. And we come out of the shade to the top of a hill, and she says, "There! That was exciting, wasn't it?" As if she was talking about no more than a walk through the haunted house at the Freiburg Fair. About 5 minutes later, we swung onto another of her woods roads. I didn't want no more woods right then, I can tell you that for sure. But these were just plain old woods. Half an hour after that, we was pulling into the parking lot of the Pilot's Grill and Banger. She points to that little odometer for trips and says, "Take a gander, Homer." I did, and it said 111.6. What do you think now? Do you believe in my shortcut? That wild look had mostly faded out of her, and she was just Felia Todd again, but that other look wasn't entirely gone. It was like she was two women, Felia and Diana. And the part of her that was Diana was so much in control when she was driving the back roads that the part that was Felia didn't have no idea that her shortcut was taking her through places that ain't on any map of Maine, not even on those survey squares. She says again, "What do you think of my shortcut, Homer?" And I says the first thing to come into my mind, which ain't something you'd usually say to a lady like Felia Todd. "It's a real piss-cutter, missus," I says. She laughs, just as pleased as punch, and I seen it then, just as clear as glass. She didn't remember none of the funny stuff. Not the willow branches, except they weren't willows, not at all, not really anything like them or anything else, that grabbed off my hat. Not that motorway B sign, or that awful-looking toad thing. She didn't remember none of that funny stuff. Either I had dreamed it was there, or she had dreamed it wasn't. All I knew for sure, Dave, was that we had rolled only 111 miles and gotten to Bangor. And that wasn't no daydream. It was right there on the little go-devil's odometer in black and white. "Well, it is," she says. "It is a piss-cutter. I only wish I could get Worth to give it a go sometime. But he'll never get out of his rut unless someone blasts him out of it, and it would probably take a Titan II missile to do that, because I believe he has built himself a fallout shelter at the bottom of that rut. Come on in, Homer, and let's dump some dinner into you." And she bought me one hell of a dinner, Dave, but I couldn't eat very much of it. And I kept thinking about what the ride back might be like, now that it was drawing down dark. Then, about halfway through the meal, she excused herself and made a telephone call. When she came back, she asked me if I would mind driving the Go-Devil back to Castle Rock for her. She said she'd talk to some woman who was on the same school committee as her. And the woman said they had some kind of problem about something or other. She said she'd grab herself a Hertz car if Worth couldn't see her back down. "Do you mind awfully driving back in the dark?" she asked me. She looked at me kind of smiling, and I knew she remembered some of it all right. Christ knows how much, but she remembered enough to know I wouldn't want to try her way after dark, if ever at all. Although I seen by the light in her eyes that it wouldn't have bothered her a bit. So I said it wouldn't bother me, and I finished my meal better than when I started it. It was drawing down dark by the time we was done, and she run us over to the house of the woman she'd called. And when she gets out, she looks at me with that same light in her eyes and says, "Now you're sure you don't want to wait, Homer?"
I saw a couple of side roads just today, and although I can't find them on my maps, I think they might chop a few miles.
I says, "Well, missus, I would, but at my age, the best bed to sleep in is my own, I've found. I'll take your car back and never put a dent